Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Welcome to episode 25 of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, my guest is Richard Cox from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Richard works on the Digital Library on American Slavery and the People Not Property Project. And Richard is also a digital technology consultant. So welcome, Richard, to Conversations with Kenyatta. So describe your role at UNC Greensboro.
Sure. I sort of have like two different roles. One is sort of legacy, where I am working university libraries and I am the supervisor and lead web application developer, which basically means I supervise three different programmers who work for the university libraries here at UNCG. The other piece of my role is I do a lot of work with digital scholarship and community engaged scholarship with researchers on campus. And as I'm sure we'll get into, my research sort of blends those two things together nicely into what I do. So yeah, I had these divergent roles that sort of come back around together in the end.
Interesting. So how long have you been with the university?
I've been with the university since about 2006. Ooh. So quite a long time. And I've really been running the Digital Library on American Slavery since the beginning. So.
Well, of course, you know, that's what I'm interested in, and I'm sure my listeners are too. So what exactly is the Digital Library on American Slavery?
Sure. So the Digital Library on American Slavery, I'll give a brief history. It started in the really as 1990s as the work of a professor emeritus here, Dr. Lauren Schwenninger. It was the 1990s. He was traveling to courthouses around the country and looking through court records to find records that basically involved or talked about enslavement. The focus for him was, depending on, again, the 1990s, depending on the book he was researching at the time, but primarily he was finding things that related to families with a focus on enslaved people. And later on, he was also doing some research focused upon women. But again, all coming back around to enslavement and finding those records. And so he was going to courthouses and making photocopies and bringing them all back to UNCG and putting all that work into his own databases and spreadsheets for his book. As he was approaching retirement, he realized, well, I think he already knew, but he was realizing, you know, his accounts on campus were going to go away. They were going to vanish. So I need to, you know, and he realized the value of, you know, the data in his research. So he came to the university libraries, and being a library, storing information is sort of what we do. He talked to us about perhaps taking on that project, saving the data. I applied for a grant with Dr. Schwenninger. I had just arrived at UNCG, so it was really my first big project anyway. And we applied for a National Endowment for the Humanities grant to basically take his work, which was called the Race and Slavery Petitions Project, Court Petitions, and create a website for it, make it publicly facing with a focus on African-American genealogists, and go. So we applied for and got the grant and did that. It was very exciting. That particular piece of the Digital Library on American Slavery contains over 100,000 named people. And, you know, of course, tens of thousands of documents from across the country. After that, we started looking at, you know, pulling the focus back to North Carolina for a bit. Mm-hmm. And so we applied for another grant, the Institute of Museum and Library Studies, and started looking at runaway slave advertisements specifically in North Carolina, because those are deceptively simple documents. They're very small, but there's so much information about people in those. Mm-hmm. So we apply for a grant to start doing that work, and we received that grant, and we're still working on that today, but we've gotten over 6,000 of them in right now. Mm. And then, yeah, the last piece that we control is People Not Property, which is a North Carolina Slave Deeds Project. We started working on that about 3 years ago. Well, a little over 3 years ago, because we applied for a National Archives grant to do that work, which is to work in up to 26 counties in North Carolina, find deeds primarily, but not exclusive property deeds, and get them digitized, get them indexed, transcribe them if we can, and get them up and be a part of the Digital Library of American Slavery. We finished that grant up just this past October, and what we ended up getting up was records from 13 counties, which came out to be slightly over 10,000 documents and about 54,000 names. And the project still continues now. That was just the end of our grant. We're always looking to do more, and we are doing more with it. But like I said, I could talk about that for quite a while.
Well, I have some questions, though, about the grant process, right? Because I know this is something that institutions do all the time, especially for these types of projects. So you mentioned two grants you got, one for the digital library and then another one for People Not Property. Mm-hmm. The grant process, this is going to be a totally loaded question, so bear with me. But what's the typical success rate, right? Because you're applying for these grants along with, I don't know, thousands or hundreds of other institutions.
Sure.
So how likely is it that you'd be able to get a grant to fund these types of projects?
It varies depending on the funder. Okay. So when you're applying somewhere like the National Endowment for the Humanities, which is a large federal organization and is the first place humanities researchers are going to think of, your percentage chance drops a lot. There really isn't a high success rate. Like you're alluding to, there's a lot of good projects, a lot of quality projects vying for, a pot of money, a small pot of money, depending on the year. And programs also rotate through in grants. So, 1 year, a specific program might be offered that might fit what you want to do with your work. It might not be there the next year, the next 2 years. So there's that piece of it as well. So for those larger grants, that one, actually, and the other one was a National Archives grant, with the same sort of thing there. Yeah, those are, the success rate on those is often very small. But there are smaller grants as well. And sometimes those you have a higher rate, success rate with. This work tends to honestly require larger grants. So,
yeah, because you're talking about multi-year project.
Yeah. We're talking about, multi-year projects that usually will require hiring someone to work on it full-time as well. And that would come out of the grant. This type of work will generally include travel as well. So, yeah, there's a lot that goes into that. We're fortunate we already generally have the technology here, so we don't have to also, as some people do, pay for all the technology they need for these things. So, yeah.
So one of the things that's, I guess I would call it a pet peeve of mine, is that I love the work that institutions do on slavery, right? On slavery in the U.S. and that professors, scholars, historians do for their books, right? All of the stuff that they collect. But all of that information is dispersed.
I know where you're going.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know why. I think maybe I just like challenges. I've chosen that to be sort of like my soapbox or something. Like I want to get it all in one place. But it's one of those things where, because you're talking about grants, how would you suggest that folks kind of get this information off of laptops, off of sort of, that one person's database or spreadsheet and make it accessible, whether it's through the projects you do today at the institution or through other projects?
Well, that's a good question. And there's multiple ways that I could sort of attack an answer on that one. So, because I get asked that question a goodly bit, primarily by African-American genealogists who I'm very fortunate that they know my work and they trust me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it can be tricky. I mean, really the best thing to do would be to talk to someone at an institution myself or someone else, simply because, I mean, kind of what Dr. Schwenninger did, it's not so much once I'm no longer here for whatever reason, the project will still be here. The institution has that longevity that a person doesn't have. So, you know, that would be my recommendation, but often you can't, I mean, you know, you can't do that. Like for me, for example, it's actually kind of difficult to do that and merge it with the other things we're doing just because every piece of data is different, right? You know, deeds are different from manuscripts, are different from court records. And so you kind of have to have a standard way of doing it. And this is something I'm wrapping my brain around is, you know, if someone wants to give me their spreadsheet of information, I'd love to have it. How do I take care of it? Because taking care of it is the important thing to me. But if people want to do it themselves, there are options. I mean, a simple one off the top of my head would be, you know, if you're talking about spreadsheets, African-American genealogists seem to use spreadsheets a lot from my experience. Yeah, something like getting a spreadsheet in Google Drive, and then you could front a website onto that, like a Google site or even a Google form or something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that would give some access to it. So there are ways to do it. You know, the institutional route is a good one, assuming you find an institution that understands and that you feel you can trust. And they're doing this kind of work. One of the reasons some of these are so dispersed, the things institutions are doing, is if it's a researcher, they have, for example, tenure. This is something I bumped into in talking with people. They have tenure they have to work on. And of course, tenure, there's this stereotypical phrase, publish or die. So until they've got their publications that will ensure their job, they are going to hold that data to themselves because you don't want someone to publish on it. And for the longest time, I was the weirdo who was like, I'm just going to turn this around and everyone can get it. And I share the data and information with anyone who asks, and including other institutions and researchers. So yeah, why are they spread out like this? And institutions, why do they keep that? It's often the researcher is, you know, they have to think, they're thinking about their job and their research. But that's a mindset that's starting to change. And I think digital is part one of the reasons for that.
I'm happy to hear that because, you know, as a genealogist, researcher, that frustration of why won't you publish it, you know, or let people have access to it, because we're just trying to find our people, right? And that helps reconnect those families that were torn apart because of slavery. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with a lot of institutions over the years. And one of the things I pride myself on is the fact that I don't have an attachment to a particular institution. So I kind of feel like I can be the rebel coming in a little bit. And say what I want to say and, you know, don't have to worry about tenure or anything like that. But I will agree with you. I do see a lot of institutions changing in that way, sharing more information. So, you know, what made you personally decide to be a part of these projects? You know, the Digital Library and American Slavery and the People Not Property Project.
It's been an arc for me, right? So as I intimated before, you know, it was basically handed to me, in short. I got the UNCG. Dr. Schwenninger was one of the first people I worked with. So in that way, I didn't so much seek it out as it was given to me. And I certainly knew how to build the website and build, you know, understood data, but I'll be honest, I was very naive about what was in it insofar as the depth and, you know, well, it's not exactly the horrors that are in there, but the things that'll also like surprise you. And, you know, I'm also not a historian by training. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of context that I had to really dig out myself. So at the beginning it was, you know, it was given to me and I had this learning curve, but what happened to me quickly, and to be honest, pretty much anyone who ends up working with me on these projects, it tends to happen to them as well, is once you're working on this project, and I can only speak to this project, but I would wager to anyone else who's doing this sort of work, it really does just pull you in. So, within a year or two, I'm trying to figure these things out. I start, you know, digging the database, start finding out things I didn't know at the time, like things like black codes, for example. And I'm, you know, learning, you know, it's a topic these days, the things you don't learn in school. Well, I sat down in front of all this and gave myself a multi-year education. But the thing that started coming out of that, to get to your question, is because one of the people ask me a lot is, you know, what do I want to say about the work? And, you know, one of the things I say about this is we document, we don't do interpretive research. So what I mean by that is, to us, it's about getting these things here. If someone, yourself, for example, wants to use this and come up with an answer, or come up with, you know, searching for your family, please feel free. We just don't see that as our role. And I take that approach because what I've always said is my allegiance in this is to the people that are in the documents, and representing them and bringing them forward. And so whenever someone's talking to me about the project or asks something or wants something from the project, I'm always open to it. But in the back of my head, I'm always like, remember the people in the documents. Because, you know, in a lot of ways, without this project, those people would probably vanish to history. And I try to always be very aware of that and try to represent them as best I personally am capable. It was doing that research, and that got me connected to the people as I started finding more people and finding their stories. Because, as you know, there's stories in these. You think of these things as dry, especially the deeds, as dry public documents, you know. Deeds, again, you think they're property deeds. Oh, it's a mortgage to a house. No, there are people in there, and there are stories in there about people. And that's what I mean that way. So in saying, how did I get involved? I'm the head of these projects. I lead them. And, you know, People Not Property was the same way, insofar as, you know, it was another way to start finding, you know, very much for me, it's like, okay, these people, how do I find more of these people? How do I get more of these people? Up and available. So yeah, it's very much for me, it was making that connection, and then, you know, understanding that data, and then just talking to people, right? You know, talking to people who do this work, meaning, you know, primarily, to be honest, genealogists and archivists, just telling me, you know, not necessarily what my work, sometimes what my work means, but broadly, like, talking to these documents, you know, I'll have, and I'm not making this one, this is a true story. I have a grandmother from California, I'm in North Carolina, will call me up out of the blue. I don't even know how she found my office number, but it's kind of wonderful. And I talked to her for an hour, where she's telling me about her family and what she's found out about her family going back, you know, probably at least to the 1700s, if not before. I'm sure it was probably before, quite frankly. And, you know, when I tell people a story, the first time something is like, well, you know, an hour, I'm like, yeah, but it's, I don't say that like, oh God, it's an hour. I was like, it was amazing. You know, it's amazing. And so, you know, it's really, in a lot of ways, the people aspect of this, right? And on both sides is what really keeps drawing me to this, and just trying to get more information out there, try to, as much as I can, create these connections. You know, that's why some of these projects have the themes they do. People Not Property. I mean, the first word's people, right? So.
Right. Yeah. You said something that I want to kind of dive into a little bit.
Sure.
And that is some of the things you found in working on these projects that surprised you. So are there a couple of examples or anything that kind of just stands out?
Yeah. So another thing that I always preface when I talk about this is, I mentioned horrors before. One of the things that comes out of doing this work is, you know, I'm looking at these records pretty well every day. You start seeing so many of these horrible things that it's the good things that you start noticing, because it pulls you back some, right? So when I talk about that sort of thing, I always have to preface it with, like, if I'm going to say anything that is interesting or good, that's the exception, and that's why it stands out. And which is, in one level, itself is a horrible thing to say, but I think you understand where I'm going. I mean, historical trauma is a real thing, and that's an example of me dealing with historical trauma with these things. So a few things that come up, some horrible, some not. There's one where we pieced together, there was, and this is a really horrible one, one we don't know why, but this one man invariably was in court records, was trying to, you know, he was purchasing young women repeatedly. And you know, I think it was out of lack of a better word, we really think it's probably a breeding thing, which is horrible to even say, as you know, but But we don't know. So we that's another thing with a lot of these. We see things and we don't know. There are a lot of stories about people buying their own families to then, of course, emancipate them. I've found recently, I found enslaved people were being sold into piracy.
Oh.
That happened here. Yeah, it was actually, they were sold onto the HMS Revenge. So North Carolina piracy. Yeah, I found a colonial governor in some of the records who was being granted some slaves. And I found one person, his name's Africa Parker. And I can talk about him later, but he is a really interesting man that has become a piece of research for me personally, because he's I can talk about him now if you like, but
oh please, you know, do.
So, and I'll mention him again possibly later. Africa Parker. So he's a gentleman I sort of stumbled across with the Orange County North Carolina Register of Deeds, where I was looking into this gentleman because I have another research project that's unrelated. It's about North Carolina beer history. And believe it or not, these two research areas tie together. And this is one way how. So Africa Parker was enslaved. I was able to trace his enslavement back to 1776, actually. And most of this is through records that we have in DLAS, honestly. And going forward, I was able to trace each enslaver, because, I mean, as a genealogist, that's, as you know, that's the approach you have to take. Mm-hmm. One of his earliest enslavers' last name was Parker, which is, of course, how he got his last name. But his last enslaver, who eventually emancipated him, in the emancipation record, which I found, he freed Africa because Africa taught him and some other enslaved people how to brew beer and alcohol. And in doing that, basically bought his freedom. Because they were like, well, we're going to make enough money from this that you're free. What Africa did was, now wow. We're talking about, at this point, 1800 North Carolina. So it's important. He turned around and opened a distillery in Orange County in 1800. And his business partner was a gentleman who was the grandson of one of his previous enslavers. And these are all in property deeds. They were successful. I haven't gone much beyond that, but you know, they were successful enough they had business loans. Africa was also educated in some way because he could read and write. And he always signed his name, Africa Parker, a freed man. There's a lot to unpack there.
His
enslavers also were primarily Quakers, which is sort of interesting. So I was able to look through some Quaker records. So yeah, that's just, you know, mm-hmm. one example of, you know, a story. I mean, because there's, you know, and that you can, how you can dive deep in the, what mm-hmm. sort of different sorts of things these records can do and where they can take you. Yeah, I've found there's a story I was working with a graduate assistant on. This one's in some work we're doing with Washington, D.C., where there was a woman who was emancipated in Virginia. She went to D.C., came back to the former enslaver, went into an indentured contract with him. So think about I can tell from your face, the danger in every step. She left Virginia, came back to the person who had enslaved her, signed a contract with him for X amount of years, I think 2 years. And at the end of that, she's free again. And this other woman gets to go with her. And he honored the contract. And 2 years later, they were emancipated and went back to D.C. I don't know if this was her sister or her daughter. I'm assuming there was a familial relationship there, but that's an assumption. So, I mean, that's a story that's mm-hmm. fraught with details you want to know. And, you know, every step of the way there is just danger. I mean, all sorts of danger in doing that. But so who was this man that emancipated her?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's something.
Yeah. I've never heard of anything like that. And I'm sure there's many, there are all these different stories as we're talking about. But you've mentioned mm-hmm. the word trust several times, not only just the trust in that story, but also the trust in you working, you know, with genealogists on these projects. So for those listening, you know, what advice would you give genealogists to work with scholars and local officials to, you know, kind of discover and uncover histories of their counties or family histories?
One of the reasons I mentioned trust is universities, institutions have, in my opinion, well, it's not,
yes,
even, it's a, they have a poor track record with African-American communities. I'll say that in short. I mean, we can elaborate. We could spend the whole podcast talking about that. Government entities, again, same thing. You know, it's an interesting question because I can address it from my perspective, but it's the perspective of a white male who's not an African-American genealogist. So, you know, who is in the institution. So that's where part of the trust is. That's the trust problem, right? So my approach, honestly, was twofold. Number one, you know, to me, the burden is on me. So what I really did was, number one, I was fortunate enough to know a couple of people who were involved with African-American genealogy. A friend of mine named Marcellus Joyner works at the Heritage Research Center here in High Point, and so, which is in the public library, and he himself does genealogy. So I already knew him. He was one of the first people I talked to when we were talking about, especially when we were talking about deeds, because that was a shift, because I really, really, really wanted that to be a community engaged partnership. I have to lead it, but I want it to be partnerships and meeting everyone's needs. And so he actually sort of got the ball rolling insofar as, well, there's Afro-American, Historical and Genealogical Society, and they met there. And so I started talking to them as well. And, you know, from there, locally, I know I'm building relationships. I'm coming from the institution. I understand I'm not here to take anything of yours, which that's, you know, I'm here, you know, how can we work together? And I was fortunate in doing that, that a lot of people already knew about the Digital Library in American Slavery from when we had initially, you know, put it up. It, people found it like they do. It's on the web. And so I already had that honestly behind me, going for me. And then, you know, as we started doing this work and these people started realizing, I really mean it when I say, this is a community thing. I'm going to take your input as, you know, and as much as I can, given the constraints, I'm going to do my best to implement and do what you say. You know, I think that it worked out really well so far, knock on wood. It's been great. And so it's very much talking to people. It's a simple answer, but it's been very much talking to people and just being honest and, you know, and upfront. You know, we've had some difficult conversations, but you're going to, and that's the trust as well. You know, we're sitting in a room together and everyone can be honest about what they think and about approaches that may be better or worse than another approach. So, but that's, again, that's, you know, building that understanding of one another. So it's, you know, I hate saying it's hard work because that sounds negative, but it's not. I mean, it's building bridges. And sometimes that takes effort because it's important to remember it's not just you. If you're talking about me here or someone in my position, it's both the legacy behind me as a white man, but also the legacy of the institutions I'm a part of. I'm at a university that's a state government agency, and all of that is back there as well. So, you know, it's one of the things that I talk about, you know, and I've had people tell me is, like, in a lot of ways, and I'm not just talking about genealogists here, there are others as well. They really look at it as they're not actually working with the university. They're working with me personally. And so, you know, I really value that.
Yeah, I think with the, and I can see that and understand it, because for the folks I work with that are at various institutions around the country, I never look at it, you know, like I've worked with the University of Mississippi. I never look at it that I'm working with the University of Mississippi. It's like the folks that are there, right? The professors and who are really trying to uncover and honor, you know, the history of the enslaved on campus. And I totally, wholeheartedly understand and agree with you around just the relationship, the problematic relationship between higher education institutions and African Americans, you know, just across the country, right? I mean, there's just so many different stories. You could think, oh, well, it's a Northern institution versus a Southern institution. No, still, there was problematic behavior everywhere. But I do feel like in the years since I've, you know, moved to California and I came out here really trying to start a company kind of dedicated to finding enslaved folks and making records available online, that the discussion around slavery and the enslaved has changed, at least within the past 5 years, probably even longer. Have you seen that with these types of projects that people are more willing, whether at the institution or outside of the institution, to kind of discuss slavery and the impact it's had on the institution as well as the community?
Sure. So there's a group called University Studying Slavery. Yeah, that would be the group I would mention. And it involves universities, actually, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill is one, Georgetown University, et cetera. And it's the criteria for joining this group is you're joining as an institution, and the institution has to be actively, it can't be a researcher, it has to be the institution. So administrative buy-in, looking at, and for lack of a better word, coming to terms with in some way and acknowledging their past as an institution and involvement with enslavement. So there are groups and there are institutions that are working towards that. Neither I nor my work are a part of it, because University of North Carolina Greensboro here was founded after enslavement.
Right.
So we have no, there are other problematic things, of course, but enslavement itself, which is what, you know, we have no connection to directly. So that's a group. There are research efforts. Some researchers that are now looking towards, you know, putting this work online. I don't know if I'm first, but I was probably one of the earliest. Cornell University is doing some work with putting runaway slave advertisements online. We've already given them all of ours, so that's there. There's the enslaved.org portal that pulls together a lot of these things that's publicly facing. And you mentioned Mississippi, so there's a Lantern Project there, and I consult with them on some, not actively, I wrote them a letter. And they're, hopefully we're going to have their data once they finish doing their work with records there, and they promised it to us. I think that's really happening. I think in my opinion, and I'm not referring to any of these projects specifically, this is just a broad observation, I think a lot of these efforts could stand to be more community involved and community engaged. There's something wrong with putting the stuff online and said, we're doing this for the African American community. You know, that's like, well, what are you really doing?
Right. Yeah. And I think community involvement, I think that's important, because there's that lack of trust, right, that comes from the community when you're taking on a project. If you have a plantation record or some type of journal, diary, whatever, of an enslaver, you know, what are you doing with that information? And how are you connecting people, you know, the descendants to that information, right? And why you should be doing that, right? Does the institution even think it's important to find these people or to help these enslaved folks, their descendants, find them, right? There needs to be some type of effort on both sides of that. And I have worked with Dr. Baptist at Cornell, and I've attended University Studying Slavery conferences at UVA as well. So very familiar. I've kind of plopped myself in the middle of that just because I was like, I need to know what's going on. And of course, at my alma mater, Michigan State, with enslaved.org, I haven't engaged as much with them, surprisingly, but I have, you know, I'm well aware and familiar with their projects and things that are going on. So there's a lot of momentum. There should be more community involvement. I do think one reason why there's not as much community involvement, just because there's a technology piece behind it. There's the money piece, the grants that we talked about earlier. And then there's the kind of traditional part of academia, right? Are we creating this for the community or creating this for other scholars? And if we're creating for the community, then okay, we could say that, but do we really know what that means? And then once we get the community members involved, everyone has a very different opinion of how this information should be shared, displayed, or whatever. So it's, it becomes challenging, I think, to do that.
Right. No, and
but institutions need to do it anyway.
Right? You're absolutely correct. Up, down, left, and right. The, you know, it's a challenge. And so deeds, people, not property. I'll use this for an example. You know, when I was working on that, I mentioned, you know, talking to Marcellus. But what I did ended up doing was I pulled together what became my advisory board on the project. But I pulled together, you know, historians and scholars. I pulled together archivists and genealogists and public officials, elected officials, all in one room. And I had to have some people tell me this could go sideways and people have a lot of different needs. I mean, generically, I mean, elected officials have to worry about an election. For example, do genealogists and archivists have the same end goals? But to be honest, we got the room together. Everyone agreed because I was like, the first thing I was like was, what should I be doing? And they were like, deeds. Deeds are what you should be doing. And everyone agreed. And we've started moving forward. And, you know, we've had discussions, but we've never, and this group with all these different walks of life and professions, we've never had a problem. And we've never had views that have been so opposing that, you know, we left the room upset. Usually we leave the room laughing and talking. I mean, but you're right. I mean, that's a perception I get. And your traditional institutions in academia, you're absolutely right. And I think that is some of what happens is these go up and you don't know who your user are, or you didn't talk to them, or you are still in that traditional research mindset where you are just taking your work and putting it up and you're not thinking about who it's for other than it's what you did and you're putting up there and there it is. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, through these types of efforts, right, we can kind of change that. I think from the genealogy side, one of the challenges that we have, or at least I've heard from people, is that, you know, historians think genealogists are just hobbyists. So there's always this thing where, you know, the two don't necessarily talk. I mean, that's changed since I've been involved in genealogy for 20 years, but that was often something I saw. One of the things I wanted to make sure didn't happen again, right? Or anymore, right? To really have us collaborate, because the work that we're doing, the work you're doing, the work that other folks are doing, we're all kind of working towards the same goal. And it is to, you know, to help people find their people and get these stories out there and not let these folks, you know, be vanished or gone from history, right? Because they're important. Yeah. As you say, they're people, not property, right? So that's really what we want to do. But switching just a little bit, what record set or set of records, I should say, would you like to see digitized that hasn't been digitized yet? I mean, I know, again, you could probably have a whole podcast about that, but if you could choose one or two.
Yeah. There's one that's I've been following, which is, and I don't know if this is recent or not. You would, as a genealogist, have a better idea than I would, but cemetery records, African-American cemetery records, or, you know, older cemetery. That, you know, I've seen, you know, there's efforts around here, for example, of, you know, mapping these cemeteries once you find them and, you know, figuring out how you could actually figure out, you know, who's buried. That would be, that's valuable. And that's pulling some of that in with some of these other projects, I mean, I think would be amazing because, you know, in theory, because I can only imagine how difficult it is to, you know, find a empty grave marker and figure out what's happening there. In theory, you have the same sort of things we're doing with this, right? A person, there might have a family, it might, you know, have all this information. You know, plus it's another piece of history where, you know, there was a recent story where someone found a graveyard, honestly, a cemetery, because they happened to be moving a road and they weren't, you know, they weren't consciously getting ready to dig up a cemetery. They didn't know, but there it was. So, you know, I just find that I'm really excited about that work in general. And, you know, I don't know of a project that's trying to bring all that together or do anything with it to scale, I guess is a way to put it, but that's exciting to me. Another thing we stumbled across that I should have known about was tax records. So then there were laws passed in North Carolina in late 1850s or early 1860s, if I remember. This was basically saying slave people could be taxed as real estate property. Well, at that point, you know, it gets into why we're doing property deeds in the first place. So, you know, a member of my team basically stumbled across these tax records while working in our state archives and wasn't expecting it. And he just started, like, he pulled his phone out and just started taking a picture of every page. And we've got them, you know, just so we know they're there. But tax records, I mean, you know, that's one of the things about the project. And that's how I have to think about when you're about what records would you like to do? It's, I have to go to that horrible place in my mind where I stop thinking about people as people. I'm like, okay, well, what, you know, how would an enslaver or someone have done this sort of thing? Honestly, bank records, people defaulting on loans. I've seen that. So there's, you know, you really do have to think outside of the box, because, you know, we're talking about people who were not acknowledged as people. And how do you get to that? So you very much have to think about it in ways that might make you uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
And should make you uncomfortable, but you know, it's what you have to do.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up tax records, because we do use those in doing our research. And you're right, it is something to, you know, you have to think outside of the box. So you have to put yourself, try to at least put yourself in the mindset of that enslaver and kind of what was going on at that time, to think of all the places in which an enslaved person might be named, right? Which documents they may show up in. And that's part of, you know, the word trauma came up earlier, and that is part of the trauma, right? As a African-American genealogist, as someone who's researching your family history, and your folks were enslaved, then it's that trauma of you're to look for someone in a deed, right? Or to even just African-American cemeteries. You're talking about that. I was thinking, I'm doing research for my book, and I was looking for a cemetery, and like the death certificate said where this person was buried, but the cemetery in like Philadelphia or somewhere just like moved. And it was like, you look on Google Maps or something, there's like a picture of a building, you know, and you're just like, what happened here? Like, how did this even occur? So it's just stuff like that, whether it's not even just the trauma of slavery, but it's just not even respecting the, you know, the grave sites of these folks. So since you do this work, have you done your own family history? Have you had any interest in finding out about your people since you've been researching other people?
I have not. My sister has done some work, though, and, you know, it's going to be basically the same there. But the short version is, you know, my family is from the mountains of Tennessee, basically. And pretty much, trying to remember, because of course she had her DNA done,
of course,
which is of course, you know, genealogists these days, that's what you need to do. So primarily English. There is a little Africa in there, a little Cherokee, which is such a stereotype in this area. Everyone wants to say they have Cherokee in them. I do, but a lot less than my mom told me, to be honest. much less. And I'm sure you've heard this sort of thing as well. Yeah. So, you know, yeah, it's really interesting to me, but I honestly have not really dug into it myself. Mm. I can only imagine the stories there, you know.
Well, everyone has a story, right? I mean, I think one of the things for me I found out in doing genealogy is I started doing my ex-boyfriend's family. And it was because my family was just farmers in Central Virginia. And I was like, there's nothing there. And then, of course, you know, I open up kind of this, there's so much there to unpack. So I'm a firm believer that everyone has a story, no matter where your family is from. Because, you know, I never thought, I'm sure you never thought you'd be living through a global pandemic. So there's a story there, just a little bit, you know, of all the things we've been through since 2020. You know, I mean, that's just one little slice of it. So my last question for you, though, is sort of what's next for you? You have these two amazing projects, but do you have anything else coming up on the horizon?
Well, just briefly with those projects, there's always more going on with them. So I currently have a grant that I'm on with three other institutions in North Carolina. And it's three other, it goes back to what I said before, community engaged, their professors, their community engaged projects working in their area with me in the background with Digital Library and American Slavery, like to be there. So one of them's researching and doing some community history on a historic Black neighborhood that's really important in Durham, North Carolina. And then someone else is looking and is in the coast. And so they're doing, it's their work. I stay in the back. Like I said before, I really want to just support people. So we're doing that work. We mentioned enslaved.org earlier. I'll be working with them later this year to see how we can start to hear what you were saying about getting these stuff out there. How can we integrate our projects in some way and make them work better for people. So, and I'm always applying for more grants for that work. And then I mentioned earlier that, you know, my other project that I work on with some other researchers is documenting the history of beer and brewing in North Carolina, which ties together. I have been able to, in a couple of ways, like I mentioned, Africa Parker, do the same things, try to surface African-American names where I can. And I found some really, really, like you're saying, everyone has a story. I found some really interesting people. And so that's a great project as well. So yeah, it's, you know, all cylinders forward on just more with the Digital Library and American Slavery, and as more community engaged work with it is really where I am.
That's great. I mean, I do, you know, I'm not a big beer drinker, but I do like the that project.
Yeah, you don't have to be. It's like it's like you were saying. I mean, the stories are there, and one of the things we say about that history is, if you really look at it, beer history is American history for good and bad. You've got an immigrant story in there. You know, like I say, I mentioned Africa Parker. It turns out he might have been probably the first African American business owner in that county.
Wow.
It comes around. You know, the first woman to run a major brewery as a Miller Brewery was here in North Carolina. She was African American and graduated from Bennett, which was HBCU that was women only.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they come around. I mean, it's a story. So it's a story of her it's a story, you know, of the South and America, but you know, beer is a nice layer to get people's interest, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so, I mean, that's, it is very interesting and intriguing. Yeah. I mean, now, of course, I'm going to have to like look it up and try and read more. Definitely Africa Parker, great name, who is very interesting. And there's so many stories like that. And I do, you know, I appreciate the work that you do. And that's why I wanted to have you on the podcast, because it's important for people to understand these resources that are there. I've looked at actually both projects in my research, but I think it's good for people to know, because one of the challenges, and you're going to wholeheartedly agree with me, is, as you talked about, enslaved.org is getting it out there. Just for the average researcher, they know the major sites to go to, but where you get where they, to use a phrase we used in corporate, the rubber meets the road, is when you get to, you know, these regional county level resources that really dig deep into the area where your ancestors were enslaved and lived. That's where you find these nuggets of gold and great stories. So I am excited to see what you do next. And definitely, as you continue to work, I will try to get you back for an update. Because
I would love to come back. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time today. And I look forward to checking in with you soon.
Thank you so much.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl, and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com. As a reminder, the views expressed by guests on Conversations with Kenyatta are their own and do not reflect the views of Kenyatta D. Berry.